Have you ever really thought about what's actually holding up the built environment around you? I mean, like a skyscraper or a deep sea pipeline under just, crushing pressure and freezing temperatures.
Right, we just sort of assume the material is this absolute given, like it's just big, thick steel, so obviously it's safe.
Yeah, but if that steel shatters, I mean, it is an absolute catastrophe. And what if I told you the only thing keeping that massive structure from ripping apart isn't just the sheer thickness of the metal?
It's actually, well, it's this invisible world, a microscopic dance of atoms that's dictated by a highly specific, kind of mysterious mathematical fudge factor of exactly 0.289.
Okay, let's unpack this because today's deep dive is incredibly fascinating. We are looking at a highly technical 1986 paper from the Fourth Scandinavian Symposium on Material Science.
Which took place in Trondheim, Norway.
Right. And these researchers, they essentially decided they were tired of just guessing. They wanted to mathematically engineer a weld that was exceptionally strong, but, and this is the key part, wouldn't shatter under immense pressure.
Yeah, and their proposed solution for this was adding two very specific elements to the steel recipe, which are chromium and molybdenum.
Which sounds simple enough, right? Just to throw in some new ingredients. But why those two elements specifically?
Well, they highlight this classic engineering trade-off. Because in metallurgy, you can easily make a metal incredibly hard.
Right.
But the problem there is that hardness often equals brittleness. Like
Yeah.
if you strike a super hard metal, it doesn't bend. It shatters like glass.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you don't want a glass bridge.
Exactly. What these researchers were chasing was toughness,
Toughness, okay.
which is a material's ability to absorb kinetic energy and, deform slightly before it actually breaks.
Right.
They wanted the sheer strength that chromium and molybdenum provide, but they desperately needed to preserve that underlying toughness.
Which means they had to treat the welding process like almost like a microscopic baking recipe.
Right, yeah.
They weren't just melting two pieces of metal together and hoping for the best. They were studying exactly how the liquid metal cools down into a solid, because that cooling process completely dictates the shape of the microscopic crystals inside the weld.
It dictates everything, yeah.
And the way this paper describes the initial state of the metal, like right after the blowtorch moves away and it's still blindingly hot, is wild. They call it austenite.
Austenite, yeah.
Huh.
That is the foundational phase of this hot steel.
Okay.
Picture a microscopic honeycomb made of hexagonal prisms.
Hexagonal prism.
Yeah, it's a very structured, high-energy geometric space. But as the weld loses heat to the surrounding air, that austenite honeycomb becomes unstable.
Right, it can't stay that way.
Exactly. It has to transform into different, more stable structures, which metallurgists call ferrite.
Okay, so I was reading through the sequence of transformations, and I came up with an analogy to try and picture what is happening to all these atoms as the honeycomb cools.
I love a good analogy. Let's hear it.
So imagine that initial hot austenite is like a massive empty ballroom, and a huge crowd of people, which are the atoms, are suddenly just let inside.
Okay, a microscopic ballroom.
Yeah. And because it's hot, there's a lot of energy. People are moving around. First, you get the people who just want to, casually line the walls of the ballroom. The paper calls this allotriomorphic ferrite.
The wallflowers of our microscopic ballroom.
Exactly. They grow slowly at the boundaries of that honeycomb structure. And they do this through a diffusional mechanism.
Right.
It's polite. The atoms are shuffling around using the ambient heat energy to literally physically migrate and find a spot along the edge.
And what's fascinating here is that this diffusional mechanism is heavily reliant on time and thermal energy.
Because they need the heat to move.
Right. Heat literally provides the kinetic energy those atoms need to move from point A to point B.
Yeah.
But as the weld continues to cool, the temperature drops below a critical threshold.
The room gets cold.
The room gets cold, and that slow, polite diffusion becomes impossible. The atoms are losing the heat energy they need to travel. They become sluggish.
So they literally lose the energy required to casually stroll to their places along the wall.
Exactly.
And that's when the vibe in the ballroom completely changes. Suddenly, this whole other group of people violently pushes their way straight into the center of the dance floor in these rigid, straight lines.
Ah, yes. The paper calls these Widman-Stettin ferrite plates.
Right. And they shoot into the austenite honeycomb through a sudden displacive mechanism.
Displacive is the absolute key word there. Since the atoms don't have the heat energy to wander individually anymore, the extreme cooling basically forces the metal's internal structure to aggressively snap into a new shape just to stabilize itself.
Wow.
Yeah, they shift position collectively and rapidly. It's a kinetic shear reaction, almost like a military formation snapping to attention all at once.
Okay, so we have the wallflowers forming by slow diffusion. We have the line dancers aggressively shearing into the middle because it got too cold. And then we have a third group, right?
Right, the acicular ferrite.
Yeah, smaller clusters of people who just sort of gather around random cocktail tables scattered in the middle of the room. They nucleate on tiny impurities inside the grain, which the paper calls inclusions.
Dust, basically.
Yeah, specks of dust, and they grow outwards from there.
And we can't forget the stragglers, you know? Whatever tiny bit of the original austenite honeycomb is left over at the very end of this entire cooling sequence, it decomposes into what the researchers term microphases.
Right, and the paper threw out some seriously dense jargon here. Things like degenerate perlite and mixtures of martensite.
Let's translate that because it sounds intimidating.
Please do.
These microphases are essentially just structural debris. Martensite, for instance, is a crystal structure that forms when the metal cools so incredibly fast that the carbon atoms literally get trapped inside the iron lattice.
They get stuck.
Yeah. And the result is it becomes exceptionally hard, but also incredibly brittle. Much like glass, like we talked about earlier.
Right, okay.
And perlite is a layered structure of iron and carbon. When they call it degenerate, they basically mean it formed imperfectly because it was just squeezed into whatever tiny gaps were left over at the very end of the cooling process.
It sounds like a complete microscopic traffic jam.
It really is.
You have plates snapping into place, clusters growing around dust, and glass-like debris filling the cracks. But here is the massive pivot of the Trondheim paper. The researchers didn't just want to look at this traffic jam under an electron microscope after the metal had already cooled.
No, they wanted to mathematically predict exactly how it would play out.
Purely based on the chemical recipe.
They wanted to build this thermodynamic model that could look at the exact weight percentages of things like carbon, silicon, manganese, and of course, chromium and molybdenum.
Right, the special ingredient.
Exactly. And combine that with the cooling rate of the weld and essentially just output the precise microscopic structure.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting, but also a bit dense. Because if you're listening to this and you've ever worked with metal, like a lathe or a blowtorch, you're probably thinking, you can't do metallurgy on a chalkboard.
It's a very physical science.
Right. And you'd be right to be skeptical. Historically, metallurgy was the definition of trial and error. You mix some metals, you quench them in water, you hit them with a hammer, and you see if they break.
Yeah, totally.
So wait, I want to make sure I'm getting the scale of this right. Are these scientists really claiming they can plug elements into an equation and know exactly how the microscopic crystals will arrange themselves without ever actually turning on a blowtorch?
That was the goal, yeah.
Wow.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the holy grail of material science. Moving an entire field from physical trial and error to theoretical thermodynamic predictive design.
Okay, so how do they even start to map that out?
We use something called time-temperature transformation diagrams. Basically, these are charts featuring two overlapping curves shaped like the letter C.
Wait, why C curves? Are we mapping time against temperature here?
We are. The vertical axis is temperature, and the horizontal axis is time. So at very high temperatures, near the top of the C, atoms have plenty of energy to move, but there is very little thermodynamic driving force to actually change their structure.
They are happy as they are.
Exactly. But at very low temperatures, down at the bottom of the sea, there's a massive driving force to change structure, but the atoms are entirely frozen. They have no energy to move.
Ah, okay. So the nose of the C curve, like that bulge right in the middle, is sort of the Goldilocks zone?
Yes.
It's the exact temperature where the metal has both the driving force to change and just enough heat energy left for the atoms to actually pull it off.
Precisely. And they use two of these C curves in their model.
Mm.
The upper C curve predicts the timing for those slow diffusional changes. The allotriomorphic ferrite, the wallflowers, and the lower C curve predicts the timing for the sudden displacive transformations, the Widman-Staten plates. And the mathematical model factors in a very specific crossover temperature called T1.
T1, that's the exact moment the room gets too cold for polite mingling.
Down to the fraction of a degree.
That's
below T1, the mathematical model dictates that slow growth ceases completely, and the sudden kinetic displacive growth mathematically takes over.
That's incredible.
They literally numerically integrated complex equations to calculate the half thickness of these microscopic layers. They factored in the cooling time, how fast the crystals lengthen, and even the point where growing crystals physically crash into each other.
Which they call hard impingement, right?
Right, hard impingement.
So they build this beautiful, incredibly complex mathematical model. But to actually test it on real welds containing chromium and molybdenum, they hit a snag.
A pretty big one.
Because to test their chalkboard math, they had to actually get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
They created 6 distinct manual metal arc welds.
Welds 1 through 6.
Right. And they kept the physical parameters constant, the joint design, the thickness of the steel plates, the electrical current of the welder, but they systematically varied the chemistry.
They ramped up the weight percentage of chromium up to about 0.6% and molybdenum up to about 0.64%.
And then they put the physical metal under a microscope to see if it matched their overlapping C curves.
And like you said, they hit a snag. Now, to be fair, the initial correlation was actually pretty decent.
Yeah, the paper notes a correlation coefficient of R equals 0.9237, which in material science of 0.92 means your math is largely predicting reality.
But there was a persistent glaring error in the model. The math consistently overestimated the amount of Widmanstetten ferrite.
Those are the rigid plates shooting into the center.
Exactly. The physical reality of the metal was stubbornly refusing to follow the equations. The presence of chromium and molybdenum was somehow physically stopping those displacement plates from forming as much as the baseline thermodynamics predicted they should.
Which brings us to the absolute most mysterious part of this paper. To fix their predictive model, the researchers basically introduced a multiplier.
Right.
They took the calculated nucleation rate of that specific displacive ferrite and multiplied it by 0.289.
They literally slashed the mathematical growth rate by over 70%.
Yeah. And the moment they applied this 0.289 multiplier, the model almost flawlessly matched reality. The correlation jumped to an incredible R equals 0.9987.
A near perfect alignment between theoretical physics and actual metal.
But so what does this all mean? I mean, multiplying by 0.289 just to force the equation to match the microscope. Are we sure they didn't just reverse engineer a mathematical fudge factor to make their homework look right?
I know, it's the natural skepticism every engineer has when they see a highly specific constant just, you know, introduced into a formula out of nowhere.
Right. Like, oh, I'll just multiply by 0.289 and we're good.
But this isn't just arbitrary math. It actually represents a hidden physical reality. The 0.289 multiplier is the numerical footprint of physical suppression. The data unequivocally show that adding chromium and molybdenum acts as a massive roadblock to the formation of Widmanstetten ferrite plates.
So those specific elements are basically acting like bouncers in our microscopic ballroom, yeah, actively stopping those atoms from rushing the center.
That's exactly what's happening.
But does the paper explain why chromium and molybdenum do this, like at the atomic level?
This is where the paper shows remarkable scientific honesty. The authors outright admit they don't fully know the atomic mechanism.
Wait, really?
Yeah. In their conclusion, they state there is a critical need to investigate whether chromium and molybdenum remain in solid solution during these phase transformations.
Okay, let's clarify solid solution for a second.
Yeah.
That's when atoms of one element hide within the main matrix of another element, right?
Right.
Sort of the same way, like sugar dissolves invisibly into a cup of hot tea. The sugar doesn't form a clump at the bottom. It just seamlessly blends into the liquid.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The researchers suspect that the atoms of chromium and molybdenum might be staying dissolved in the background iron matrix as the metal cools.
Okay.
And by just existing in that space, they might be physically getting in the way or, you know, drastically altering the thermal energy required for those specific Widmanstetten plates to shear into place.
But they hadn't proven the exact physics of it.
No, they just knew that mathematically the suppression happens, and it happens at a constant rate of 0.289.
So their chalkboard math is beautifully tuned now. They have a theoretical model that can accurately design the microscopic landscape of a weld.
Yes.
But as any welder standing on a cold scaffolding will tell you, the ultimate test of a steel joint isn't a correlation coefficient on a piece of paper.
Definitely not. Mathematical elegance means very little if the metal just shatters under stress.
Right.
Which is why the final section of this Trondheim paper moves away from theoretical physics and into brute force mechanical testing. They needed to validate the physical toughness of these carefully predicted microscopic structures.
And they started with Vickers hardness tests, which basically measures how resistant the metal is to being dented or scratched.
Standard stuff.
Yeah. But the true trial by fire, or rather trial by ice, was the Charpie toughness test.
Oh, the Charpie test is intense.
I actually looked up a video of a Charpie impact machine. It is so intensely visceral. You take a thick, meticulously machined piece of the weld. You cut a small notch into the side of it and secure it in a vise.
Right.
Then you literally release a massive weighted pendulum. It swings down and violently strikes the metal at the notch.
And the machine then measures exactly how much kinetic energy the metal absorbs before it completely fractures and snaps in half.
And that absorbed energy is measured in joules.
Exactly. It is a brutal physical test of that engineering trade-off we discussed at the very beginning.
Mm.
Did the chromium and molybdenum give them the structural strength they wanted without turning the metal brittle?
And they didn't just test these six welds in a comfortable room temperature laboratory. They were looking at real-world applications.
Right, pipelines, bridges.
Exactly. So they tested welds 1 through 6 at 20 degrees Celsius, which is room temp, then dropped it to negative 20, negative 40, and finally all the way down to a freezing negative 60 degrees Celsius.
The temperature variable is so crucial here because cold strips away the metal's ability to deform.
It freezes the atoms.
Yeah. Now, at room temperature, all six welds performed wonderfully. They were absorbing anywhere from 194 to 216 joules of energy before breaking.
So they were incredibly tough.
Very tough. But as the temperature dropped, the true nature of those microscopic crystal structures revealed itself. At negative 60 degrees Celsius, the toughness plummeted across the board.
And the metal was just losing its ability to absorb the pendulum's energy.
Right, but it didn't just drop evenly. This is the part of the data that really stood out. Weld 1, which was their baseline weld with zero molybdenum in it, dropped down to 67 joules at negative 60 degrees.
Okay, so significantly weaker, but 67 joules means it still put up somewhat of a fight before snapping?
Right. Now compare that to Weld 6.
Weld 6 had the absolute highest concentration of molybdenum, right? Sitting at 0.64%.
Yes.
When they swung that heavy pendulum at Weld 6 at negative 60 degrees Celsius, it only absorbed 29 joules of energy.
29 joules is a catastrophic failure. I mean, the metal behaved almost like a sheet of ice.
Yeah.
It just shattered with virtually no resistance.
Wait, so if you are an engineer listening to this and you're designing a research station in Antarctica or a deep sea pipeline, this 1986 paper is giving you a very specific flashing red light warning.
Absolutely.
Do not use high concentrations of molybdenum in your steel welds if the structure is going to be exposed to freezing cold environments.
The paper literally spells it out for them. It says, for service at negative 60 degrees C, it may be advisable not to use high concentrations of Mo.
Wow.
And this raises an important question, right? It highlights the absolute limits of relying solely on engineering models.
Because the math said it should be fine.
Exactly. The theoretical math we just spent so much time dissecting worked beautifully for predicting the microscopic structure. It perfectly mapped out the volume fractions, the allotriomorphic ferret, and the displace of plates using that 0.289 adjustment.
Right.
But those mathematical C curves didn't tell them that Weld 6 would catastrophically shatter at 29 joules in the freezing cold.
The chalkboard math tells you what the metal is, but the swinging pendulum tells you what the metal can actually do when the environment turns hostile.
Yes. You need both the theoretical prediction and the empirical destruction to truly understand the boundaries of the material.
It is the synthesis of calculation and consequence. It really is a wild journey to think about.
It really is. I mean, we started by zooming in on a microscopic honeycomb of hot austenite, right?
Mm.
This tiny ballroom of high-energy atoms.
Yeah.
We watched a temperature drop, seeing how the atoms either slowly shuffled to the walls through heat diffusion or just aggressively sheared into the center when the cold sapped their energy.
Then we saw researchers successfully predict these invisible movements using thermodynamic C curves. And that super mysterious 0.289 multiplier.
The bouncer of the ballroom.
Exactly. And finally, we saw them take that perfectly modeled metal and just violently smash it at 60 degrees below zero to find its ultimate breaking point.
And, you know, this journey leaves us with something quite profound to consider, especially today.
Ooh.
Because the authors of this 1986 Trondheim paper prove their predictive mathematical model works flawlessly, right?
Okay.
As long as they use that 0.289 adjustment.
Right.
Yet they openly admitted they still didn't fully understand the underlying atomic physics of why those elements acted as a roadblock. They knew that the math worked perfectly, but the logical why remained completely hidden.
The mechanism was basically a black box. The input and the output matched perfectly, but the middle was just a mystery.
Exactly. And consider how often we do this in our modern, hyper-connected world. We rely on highly complex, increasingly opaque mathematical models.
Like algorithms.
Like algorithms curating the information we consume,
mm.
or AI systems making rapid-fire financial or logistical decisions.
Right.
We can measure the correlation, we know the math works, and the output is highly accurate.
Right.
But we often don't fully understand the underlying logical why inside the black box that generated that result. We just lean on the equivalent of mathematical multipliers to bridge the gap between mm-hmm. what we can accurately predict and what we actually fundamentally comprehend.
Wow, that is a brilliant parallel. We're essentially trusting the 0.289 multiplier of the algorithm to keep the structure standing, even if we can't see the atoms moving inside.
Exactly.
Definitely something to chew on the next time you drive your car over a massive steel suspension bridge, trusting all those microscopic honeycombs to hold together in the cold.